authority to establish a resistance movement in North Vietnam and combine it with a Safe Areas program. SAFE was the acronym for Selected Areas for Evasion, and the program evolved from a Strategic Air Command plan to recover nuclear bomber crews from remote regions of the USSR, in turn an idea not without precedent. During World War II, the American OSS and British Special Operations Executive, SOE, working with Tito's guerrillas, maintained enclaves deep in Nazi-occupied Yugoslavia for bailouts and emergency landings. Likewise, during the Korean War, the CIA had guerrilla bands on many offshore islands where crippled planes could ditch and flyers could bail out. SOG wanted similar safe areas west and north of Hanoi, where pilots could bail out and receive medical aid, food and protection, then be retrieved by helicopters from Laos. When properly armed and supported by TAC Air, SOG's safe area guerrillas could defend their zone. If confronted by a powerful force, they just melt away. But for political reasons, SOG was denied the authority to raise a North Vietnam resistance movement, even though it would have saved some downed pilots. Similar proposals for safe areas in Laos, too, were rejected by the U.S. ambassador in Vientiane, William Sullivan. SOG still did what it could to enhance the survival chances of downed Americans. One major contribution was running special recon missions along the Laos-North Vietnam border to identify escape routes. During one such mission lasting 19 days, Sergeant First Class Bob Howard explored small east-west valleys to find out-of-the-way mountain passes through which U.S. evadees in North Vietnam's panhandle could escape safely into Laos. SOG also sought to create safe areas in its own assigned slice of Laos, 12 miles adjacent to South Vietnam, where many U.S. planes were shot down while bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail. However, nearly every tribal village in the area had been long abandoned, their Ka and Katu inhabitants fleeing westward to avoid impressment as NVA road repair crews and porters. Another SOG Bright Light contribution came via its unique USAF transport unit. The 90th Special Operations Squadron, SOS, whose MC-130s were the war's only aircraft outfitted with a Fulton recovery system, Skyhook. Assigned directly to SOG, the 90th SOS MC-130s were the most advanced transport planes in the world, with secret electronic countermeasures and computerized navigation instruments for penetrating heavy anti-aircraft threat areas. As well, the 90th SOS planes employed radically new top-secret night-viewing sensors. Forward-looking infrared, FLIR, that rendered the darkest night daylight clear on a TV screen, and even could see through rain or fog and into foliage. The SOG MC-130 was distinguished by its black and dark green paint job, removable U.S. insignia, and a 20-foot Fulton Skyhook yoke swung back against its nose. Whenever these black planes appeared, real spook stuff was underway. Nicknamed Blackbirds, the SOG MC-130s typically taxied to some out-of-the-way airfield corner to pick up troops packing strange submachine guns or unload men in North Vietnamese uniforms who scurried into unmarked civilian vans and sped away. The 90th SOS had arrived in Nha Trang, South Vietnam, in December 1966, from Ching Chuan Kong Air Force Base, Taiwan, where they'd been based for several years. The unit arrived as the 15th Special Operations Squadron. The 90th SOS led a secret double life, in daytime flying seemingly routine transport missions in South Vietnam, and at night airdropping supplies to agent teams in North Vietnam, or parachuting SOG recon teams along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. By 1967, the 90th SOS Blackbirds were logging four-night resupply flights into North Vietnam each month. If they went down in North Vietnam, one 90th SOS veteran recalled, the story they were to tell was that they had equipment malfunctioning, which resulted in a navigational error. To give this credibility, the Blackbirds carried phony flight plans, although it would have made little difference to the North Vietnamese. The 90th SOS worked closely with SOG's nationalist Chinese-flown first flight planes dividing these clandestine flights among them. Despite their sophisticated navigation aids and electronic countermeasures, a SOG navigator said, their success resulted from careful route planning and meticulous navigation, while the electronic wizardry was just gravy. I never felt in any particular danger, Colonel Don James, a Blackbird pilot, reported. Although the North bristled with anti-aircraft guns, SAMs, and MiGs, but those large, lumbering C-130s were not exactly nimble fighters, and any penetration of North Vietnam was hardly a casual thing. Unlike SOG's first flight detachment, the 90th SOS would not fly North Vietnam's skies without loss. But it was the amazing Fulton Skyhook that gave the Blackbirds a special role in bright light operations. In the final scene of the James Bond thriller Thunderball, a Skyhook-equipped plane lifted Bond and a female companion from a rubber raft. This was exactly what Skyhook had been conceived to do, exfiltrate people from a spot where no airplane could land. To accomplish this, a special canister was dropped from the Blackbird containing a balloon, two tanks of helium, a 1,500-foot cable, and attached combination suit harness. It took about 15 minutes to don the suit, inflate the helium balloon, and get the cable up. Meanwhile, the C-130 swung forward its nose-mounted, hydraulically-operated 20-foot yoke, which formed a wide V-shaped jaw. The pilot flew that jaw right into the cable beneath the balloon, which broke away, snatching up the passenger at 125 miles per hour. The recovered man was then winched into the C-130's tailgate. It was like bungee jumping in reverse. Co-funded by the CIA for agent extracts and by the Strategic Air Command to lift pilots from safe areas in the USSR, the Fulton recovery system was designed by Robert E. Fulton, Jr., descendant several times removed of the Robert Fulton who had invented the world's first practical steamboat. Skyhook had been used in the real world in several CIA operations prior to its arrival at SOG. In one, a Soviet military detachment had been operating a meteorological station on the Arctic ice cap, but was suddenly withdrawn when that part of it broke away as an iceberg, leaving behind their sensors and instruments. The CIA parachuted in a two-man team to recover the gear. But the iceberg began breaking up before a ship could reach them. At the last possible moment, the CIA's air branch airdropped Skyhook kits and snatched the men out with a Fulton-rigged B-17. What was it like accelerating to 125 miles per hour in 1 second? USAF Colonel Bill Page, SOG's senior air staffer, extracted for a demonstration, found it a pretty good thrill. SOG's most distinguished Skyhook passenger was Chief SOG Colonel Jack Singlob, the first man to be extracted in-country when the MC-130s arrived. The pickup went perfectly. The only thing I regretted was I hadn't told the pilot where to fly after he had me dangling out behind, Singlob recalled. I could see we were flying over War Zone D, not more than 1,000 feet up, the most heavily enemy-populated part of all South Vietnam. Skyhook was best suited for clandestine extracts, not for lifting people away under heavy anti-aircraft fire or with hostile ground forces pursuing them. To get a guy out of somewhere with a Fulton recovery system took a lot of planning, explains former SOG Blackbird pilot Colonel James. He had to be in an area where he could put this balloon up, which could alert everybody around him. Colonel Bill Page agrees, adding, "It was almost impossible to use, because by the time you fly over the guy on the ground, drop him the equipment, have him send the balloon up, make a big turnaround to come in and snag the balloon, my God, every bad guy in the world would be on top of you." Despite this, SOG Blackbird crews several times braved great hazards to go after downed pilots in North Vietnam and Laos. In one case, the downed pilot and his balloon inflated, but he'd forgotten to consider nearby obstacles he might hit when snatched up. It took a few moments to reposition himself. Then he radioed he was ready, and the Blackbird turned in for its run just as NVA soldiers swarmed over the pilot. It was the same story each time the Blackbirds attempted such rescues. POW rescue attempts by SA ground forces, too, did not fare well. There were 16 POW rescue raids in JPRC's first full year of operations, 1967, but SOG liberated just 20 Arvins and not a single American. In each case, SOG anticipated finding Americans, but discovered they'd been moved just before the raid. The failure to bring out any Americans was chalked up to bad luck and the enemy's simple security practice of moving them frequently. But there was treachery, too, though it would not be discovered for years. 5. Prairie Fire. In March 1967, the codename for SOG's Laos operations, Shining Brass, was switched to Prairie Fire to confuse outsiders who'd learned its original designation. Prairie Fire also was a term used by outnumbered SOG teams in danger of being overrun. When a team radioed a Covey fact that it had a Prairie Fire emergency, Covey would hail the USAF Airborne Command Post, a C-130 orbiting above Laos called Hillsborough in daytime and Moonbeam at night. And minutes later, Air Force, Navy, and Marine fighters began stacking up to support the endangered team with phenomenal combat firepower. Exorbitant as SOG's casualties became, they would have been even worse had it not been for this extraordinary air support. This high priority was obtained largely due to the persuasive efforts of SOG's third chief, Colonel Jack Singlob. The first chief SOG to serve a two-year tour, 1966-68, he'd spent much of his army career in special operations. During World War II, he'd been a JED, an OSS Jedburgh team member. JED was the most prestigious title in U.S. World War II special operations, comparable to SOG's 1-0. The JEDs were liaison teams that parachuted into occupied France to help the resistance demolish bridges, ambush German convoys, seize prisoners, and guide Allied units. Singlob was one of the few OSS operatives to serve in Asia, too, making a parachute jump onto Hainan Island, China, to assist in the release of American POWs just after VJ Day. Fellow JED Bill Colby left the OSS as a major and went with the new civilian intelligence agency, the CIA. But Singlob stayed with the Army and opted for special forces when it came into being. Despite a contrary official lineage, special forces' true precursor is the OSS. After World War II, Singlob twice was loaned to the CIA for highly classified Asian operations, first in Manchuria to run an intelligence net against Mao's communist forces, then during the Korean War to serve with a special operations unit similar to SOG, the CIA-affiliated Joint Advisory Commission, Korea, JACK. As the 101st Airborne Division's G3 operations officer in the 1950s, the future Chief SOG earned the personal respect and friendship of his division commander, Major General William Westmoreland. In Vietnam, their relationship was close enough that every Monday morning, the commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam spent 2 hours at SOG headquarters being briefed personally by his old G3. USAF Colonel Bill Rose, a senior SOG air officer, says Singlob didn't hesitate to criticize even three-star generals during MACV staff briefings if it was the right thing to do. "He was a ball of fire. He did a fine job," Rose said. With Westmoreland's solid support, Singlob's emphasis could be upon new technologies and new projects. Singlob imbued SOG with the OSS spirit of his old French Maquis days, when the Jeds had admonished surprise, mitraillage, évanouissement. Surprise, machine gun, vanish. After doing exactly that, a 1967 SOG operation in Laos brought Singlob into conflict with a Washington bureaucracy that did not share the JED's famous enthusiasm. It began when a helicopter gunship popped a few rockets at a fleeing NVA. Unknown to the gunship pilot, an enormous cache covered the whole hilltop. One rocket hit an explosives bunker, which went nuclear with such force it almost brought the helicopter down. A hastily assembled platoon led by Master Sergeant Bill Country Grimes inserted and swept up the hill. What they found was awesome. Stacked under the trees were tarp-covered 220-pound bags of rice, piled 5 bags wide, 4 high, as far as they could see. They counted, calculated, and what a find! It was 500,000 pounds, 250 tons, enough rice to sustain an NVA division at least 6 weeks. When that lucky rocket hit the cache's ordnance bunker, local NVA security guards had run for their lives. One by one, the SOG men dragged down each 220-pound burlap sack, sliced it open, and dumped it out, a time-consuming task. They tried to burn the rice with diesel fuel, called A1s to napalm it, even urinated on it. We cut damned rice bags from 11 a.m. in the morning until dark, and still had rice bags in front of us, recalled J.D. Bath. They spilled so much rice it looked like it had snowed on the side of that hill. For 2 days they took turns fighting NVA and dumping rice. Fortunately, the region's major NVA infantry units were 35 miles away, in South Vietnam's Play Trap Valley, fighting the U.S. 4th Infantry Division during Operation Sam Houston. Still, the platoon barely got out before a large NVA relief force arrived. A skin of your teeth escaped. Several men were recommended for awards, J.D. Bath recalled, but the unit clerk fell behind in his typing, so he tossed the paperwork and went home to the States. In Saigon, Colonel Singlob was proud his men had discovered one of the war's largest rice caches and done their damnedest to destroy it. A little later, though, there were reports of NVA soldiers in South Vietnam with burned rice in their rucksacks, the apparent salvage of the SOG raiders' handiwork. This sent Singlob right up the wall. There must be a way to destroy rice when SOG men found it, a simple, permanent technique or treatment to do the trick. He put his SOG science staff to work on it. They came back with exactly the unconventional solution Singlob thrived on. Contaminate the rice with Bitrex, an odorless chemical that made rice so bitter it was virtually impossible to swallow. Bitrex had a magnitude greater effect than alum, the closest similar compound, and could be mixed with water and poured as a liquid. Bitrex could be applied quietly, without attracting enemy attention, making it ideal for a recon team. It was not intended to poison the enemy, just destroy his food, so it did not violate the law of land warfare. Washington was aghast at SOG's proposal. What clinched it was when the Pentagon had a rat injected with Bitrex, and of course the rodent croaked. Singlob argued that he did not intend for the NVA to eat Bitrex, which was all but impossible. Indeed, he was convinced they would not eat it. But he was overruled. Another idea that Singlob championed did reach fruition, although this one came from a Recon 1-0. First Lieutenant George K. Sisler had found an almost vertical peak in southern Laos and personally carried photos of it to Singlob with a proposal to occupy it, telling him, "I am absolutely certain that I could stay on top of that rock indefinitely." Colonel Singlob liked initiative, innovation, and skydiving, and the young lieutenant had all three going for him. Singlob had first met Sisler years earlier as a competitive skydiver. As for the peak, it truly dominated southern Laos, and as Lieutenant Sisler explained, from its top could be relayed radio messages from recon teams, thus solving a deadly problem. The NVA had figured out SOG's modus operandi and had begun allowing teams to land unmolested, then waiting for the helicopters to fly well east so intervening mountains cut off the team's radio transmissions. Then the NVA hit them. A radio relay site also would be a big help at night when teams had no one to communicate with them. U.S. Ambassador to Laos, William Sullivan, didn't want any part of it. After a month of cablegrams between Saigon and Vientiane, finally a compromise was reached, and Sullivan allowed one small SOG team to use the pinnacle, provided they were armed with obsolete World War II-era weapons. They occupied the peak on 15 January 1967. Codenamed Leghorn, the SOG radio relay side was only days old when the NVA hit a just-inserted team minutes after they could no longer radio the helicopters. From his commanding perch, Sisler called back the aircraft, which plucked the team safely away. Leghorn provided a useful observation post until the NVA figured out what could be seen and masked it. When conditions were right, men atop Leghorn heard NVA bulldozers repairing bomb damage on the road network 6 miles away, but not with enough precision to direct airstrikes. After 10 days, Sisler's men flip-flopped with another team, which arrived on the birds that carried his team out. Leghorn was only intended to be a temporary outpost, but SOG would occupy it continuously for 5 years, with a small security detachment and radio operators eventually replacing the recon teams. Almost overnight, Leghorn became a must-see for passing U.S. fighters, whose pilots would sneak up at low level, then kick in afterburners and flash past low overhead. But aviators found the peak more than a curiosity. For the first time, there was a place they could bail out in southern Laos, where friendlies might hear their distress call and ensure that they were rescued. They were not Leghorn's only visitors. General Westmoreland had absolutely forbidden Sing Lob to accompany a recon team into Laos, but that didn't stop the Chief SOG from stripping off his rank and name tag and spending a day atop the peak. Westmoreland later learned of Sing Lob's Laotian escapade and damn near died, but admitted, "I should have guessed as much, Jack." Actress Martha Ray, a solid supporter of Special Forces, was smuggled to Leghorn in 1970. After singing a couple of songs and kissing each green beret, she was whisked away on the Huey that brought her. She never said a word publicly of her deliciously unauthorized visit to SOG's most secret site. Just after his 10 days atop Leghorn, Lieutenant Sisler volunteered to accompany a SOG platoon going into Laos to assess a B-52 strike. For Sisler, the BDA, bomb damage assessment, also was an opportunity to try out one of SOG's new toys, a revolutionary rocket pistol he'd just been issued, called a gyrojet. A private initiative to bring small arms into the space age, the gyrojet pistol was made mostly from stamped steel and plastic and weighed only a few ounces. It fired a thumb-sized 13-millimeter mini-rocket, propelled by solid fuel that gushed from two little canted holes in its base, spinning it like rifling. Leaving the barrel at 1,300 feet per second, the rocket emitted a noisy swoosh like a Roman candle. Firing it generated almost no recoil, and it wasn't very accurate, but it impacted with impressive effect. In one test, a rocket round punched through an old truck door and into a water-filled 55-gallon drum, almost exiting its opposite side. SOG men also test-fired it through sandbag walls and even tree trunks. The BDA platoon was commanded by Captain Edward Lassane, assisted by Sergeant First Class Leonard Tilley, a respected recon man, with Sisler going along for the experience. They inserted near Laotian Highway 96 and hardly had left the LZ when a reinforced NVA company assaulted, threw them back, and almost overran them. The SOG men put up such a fight that the enemy fell back. Then Lieutenant Sisler realized two wounded Montagnard tribesmen were almost within the enemy's grasp. Sisler raced out, lifted one man and was running with him when the NVA launched a second assault directly toward him. The Green Beret laid the yard down, destroyed a machine gun with a grenade, then killed three NVA with his Car 15. Sisler retrieved the second yard just as a 40-man NVA platoon attacked, and all alone he assaulted them, shooting and throwing grenades. In that desperate solo melee, he undoubtedly fired his remarkable gyrojet pistol, too, much to the enemy's amazement, no doubt, when tiny rockets smashed into their comrades, hitting like 50-caliber machine gun slugs. Almost single-handedly, Sisler repulsed that platoon-sized NVA attack. Meanwhile, SFC Tilley organized the rest of the men and called in tactical air support to within 50 feet of their position. But there was no place for extraction helicopters to land, so they had to move. Then an RPG anti-tank rocket detonated near Lassane, shredding his thighs and groin, and instantly he was almost bleeding to death. Everyone around Lassane was hit too. Tilly expertly directed airstrikes that at last forced the NVA back, and gunships arrived to escort the Hueys that would extract them. George Sisler stood to direct the gunships, then a sniper's round cut him down. He died there. It was only because of Tilly's leadership and skill that anyone came out, Lassane recalls. We were all crawling toward the landing zone. How we got to the landing zone, I don't know. They brought Sisler's body with them. Twice Tilly went back after wounded men and once charged directly into the enemy, which so astonished the NVA that they fell back. Despite heavy ground fire, no aircraft were lost during the extraction. When Lassane recovered enough to sit in his hospital bed, he wrote up both Tilly and Sisler for the Medal of Honor. Sisler's award was approved and presented to his widow and two young sons a year later. His was SOG's first Medal of Honor. Many SOG men thought Tilly too deserved the medal. Instead, the heroic sergeant received America's second highest award, the Distinguished Service Cross, DSC. After Sisler's death, his 1-1, J.D. Bath, was teamed up with a new 1-0, Captain Richard Leggett. A month later, he was dead too. There seemed to be a whole lot more singing Hey Blue, and it was no illusion. There had been a sea change. SOG Recon was becoming more dangerous, though no one would realize why for some time. NVA countermeasures had improved since the early Shining Brass days, when there'd been no special effort to oppose recon teams. Now every few months the NVA added another twist until, by mid-1967, the enemy's Laotian defenses were redundant, layered, and in-depth. NVA defenses began with one- and two-man LZ Watcher teams that surveilled likely insert LZs, which they correctly saw as lifelines. There wasn't much you could do to change it, Lieutenant Colonel Charlie Norton noted. We were dependent on helicopters. You needed to have an LZ. The NVA couldn't cover every piece of open ground in Laos. Master Sergeant Billy Wall thought they assigned a 2.5 square mile area to a single watcher and positioned him on high ground in the center. Several teams found watcher platforms on tall trees that oversaw enormous expanses. RT Illinois 1-0 Steve Kiever once flushed two uniformed NVA LZ watchers when his landing Huey's prop wash exposed them. The door gunner's M60 machine gun and Kiever's Car 15 eliminated the watchers, then the Huey shifted to an alternate LZ. SOG teams kept finding four-foot-wide holes scooped out of Laotian hillsides. The yards explained they were listening devices. You could dig a hole and sit beside it, and if the choppers were coming, J.D. Bath recounts, even before you heard them with your ears, you'd hear the vibrations out of that hole. When an LZ watcher spotted a helicopter landing, he reported it by phone or runner or rang a large brass gong. Nearby NVA base camps or truck parks beat their own gongs or fired signal shots to relay the alarm. Sometimes the NVA dispatched trackers, which in the early days were Laotian hill tribesmen who displayed good woodsmanship but poor tactical sense. They were hunters rather than warriors. Other times the NVA sent out people to follow a team at a safe distance and clack bamboo sticks together or fire signal shots to try to drive the team toward an ambush or away from an important NVA installation. The NVA also used trail watchers, just like they used LZ watchers, to detect SOG teams when they crossed. A major NVA advantage was their perfect knowledge of trails, which SOG men discovered only when they came upon them by chance. In a flat-out race through an LZ, the NVA often outran teams because the SOG men headed cross-country, while the NVA dashed down high-speed trails. The enemy sometimes employed radio direction finding, RDF, plotting a team's radio to within perhaps 200 yards. Although SOG never found an RDF site in Laos or Cambodia, the evidence was simply too strong to doubt their presence. For example, Sergeant First Class Newman Ruff one night spent hours radioing South Vietnam-based artillery to hit NVA convoys, then moved 300 yards away to sleep. No sooner did his team finish moving than mortar fire pounded his old position, which was then swept by NVA troops. That certainly was an RDF fix. NVA dismounted patrols didn't go into the jungle unless trackers already knew a team's whereabouts, although platoon-sized elements swept the jungle beside convoy routes each evening at dusk in search of SOG ambushers. At night, the NVA posted sentries at each road curve, perhaps 300 to 500 yards apart, who'd fire signal shots if they detected a prowling SOG team or the sound of approaching aircraft. Then the trucks would pull to the roadside or into dugout revetments. However the enemy located SOG teams, the next step was always the same. Bring in as many troops as he could, as fast as he could. The reaction force might be rear echelon logistics soldiers grabbed because they were nearby, inexperienced NVA on their way to South Vietnam, or, the toughest of all, seasoned NVA infantry resting across the border between battles in Vietnam. The NVA reinforced fast, since several infantry battalions always were but a half day's march away. They'd fan out to saturate the team's area with sweeps, ambushes, and blocking forces. SOG men learned how a hunted animal felt, because that's how the NVA pursued them. Signal shots, shouts, and clapping hands were as much to panic a team as anything else, like Indian beaters banging on pots and pans to drive a tiger into a waiting rifleman's sights. Except the recon men kept their heads and resisted moving in the direction the NVA seemed to want them to go. It required tactical acumen to slip around the noisemakers, but the options were few. Some teams boldly charged the noisemakers and shot their way through. When this worked, it was brilliant. When it failed, it seemed the height of stupidity. Teams sometimes were found because they bumped into an NVA patrol, but that was only the beginning of their troubles. In a hot area, 10 minutes later, a company-sized reaction force arrived. Unless you disappeared or were extracted, you could count on another company getting there in a half hour, and they kept arriving, particularly if you'd bloodied their noses good. The enemy sometimes trucked in reinforcements, usually after dark to avoid air attack. Many a recon team thought they'd given the slip to the NVA and were comfortably asleep in their night position when the sound of halting trucks and dropping tailgates slammed them right in the gut. But these make-do reaction forces weren't responsive enough, apparently. So the NVA added yet another defensive layer in the form of route protection battalions and rear security units, which were infantry units permanently assigned to the Ho Chi Minh Trail, to patrol against SOG recon and hatchet force operations. During World War II, the Soviets had formed identically named units within the NKVD, precursor to the KGB, to combat German raiders and saboteurs behind their lines. Assuming a SOG team managed to avoid or fight through all these impediments, the enemy still had a chance for a final blow on the team's extraction LZ by repositioning 12.7mm anti-aircraft machine guns once the team's location was first suspected. An NVA battalion's 2 dozen 12.7mm machine guns typically were dispersed to cover as many LZs as possible over an area 5 miles in diameter. His heavier flat guns, 23mm, 37mm, and 57mm, were situated to protect roads and major base areas from bombing attacks, which is why the roads were so dangerous. Operating there brought a team's choppers into the sights of the enemy's heavy anti-aircraft guns. Even if an objective was near a road, the team inserted at least a ridgeline away to give their helicopters cover from concentrated flak fire. When watchers or trackers confirmed the team's presence, the NVA toted their 2 dozen 12.7s into a closer 2-mile radius to try to cover every possible departure LZ. More than one SOG team thought they were home free, only to have their exfiltration helicopter riddled by freshly repositioned 12.7mm machine guns. By 1967, The enemy had implemented all these defensive measures in Laos and committed well over 2,500 soldiers to defend his sanctuaries and the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Add to this NVA units coming down the trail or resting in Laos after battle, and the number of soldiers occasionally doubled. Even so, the NVA's score wasn't very impressive. SOG kept about 50 Americans roaming Laos at a time, meaning each man was tying down at least 500 enemy troops, and the NVA couldn't catch even half the teams. Maybe the loss of that enormous rice cache was the final straw. But something changed dramatically in 1967, only SOG didn't realize it immediately. There'd always been incentives for the NVA to hunt down SOG men, the oldest being a special medal for killing Americans, the Huan Chuang Zung Si Jiet Mi, Order for Heroes Who Destroy Americans, nicknamed the American Killer Award, presented in three classes, apparently to distinguish a killer of one American from a mass killer. The star-shaped medal featured an NVA soldier stepping on an object labeled U.S. To sweeten the pot, a captured document disclosed the NVA added a bounty of 10,000 piastres, several months' pay, for a living or dead SOG man, a severed head being adequate proof to collect. But these incentives could not explain what had happened in the case of Master Sergeant Sam Almendarez and Robert Sullivan. In mid-July 1967, they, along with Sergeant First Class Harry Brown and five Nungs, were on a recon mission near Laotian Highway 922, about 60 miles due west of Hue, when they were ambushed, not by men firing weapons, but NVA who leaped out of nowhere. One NVA wrestled Sullivan's car 15 away from him, shot him dead, spun around and shot the team's 1-2, Brown, through the shoulder, even as another NVA shot Almendarez dead. Brown and half the team broke away and ran like hell, then Brown managed to get off a radio message. Aki San, the surviving half of that well-known flying dynamic duo, Cowboy, climbed into his H-34 helicopter as soon as he got word about Brown, and three SOG men jumped aboard after him. Master Sergeant Charles Skip Minix, that perennial recon man, Billy Waugh, and Captain Oliver Brin. Although they had no gunships or fighter support, Cowboy slowly trolled his King Bee above the treetops until, peering into the brush below, they spotted Brown and several Nungs. Cowboy tried to squeeze into an LZ so tiny his rotors chewed into overhanging branches, then slugs started thumping into the old King Bee, and finally Cowboy had to abort the landing. At Khe San, they refueled and examined the King Bee, which sported several bullet holes but was still flyable. No rational pilot should have taken an already shot-up helicopter back out there, especially with no fire support, heavy ground fire, a tiny LZ, and no other aircraft to retrieve him if he went in. Cowboy ordered his co-pilot and door gunner to stay at Khe San, and brought along only the insistent Skip Minix. At the LZ, Cowboy again descended into that narrow hole and hovered while Minix leaped off. An AK bullet passed completely through Cowboy's neck, but somehow he flew the King Bee with one hand and slowed the bleeding with the other, while Minix dragged the wounded Brown aboard and off they went. Billy Waugh still shakes his head at that display. And though Minix too showed real valor, Cowboy's bravery astounded him. "I thought he should get the Medal of Honor," Waugh said. Miraculous though that rescue was, it was what happened to Almendarez and Sullivan that was the subject of much post-action review. They had not been bushwhacked by typical NVA, not even combat-seasoned NVA. No, the ambushers were superbly camouflaged, flashed out of nowhere like ninjas, employed martial arts, and tried to take at least one American alive. Carefully planned and crisply executed, the attack had to have been rehearsed. SOG men had never before encountered NVA quite like these. 4 months earlier, about as long as it would have taken a new unit to travel down the trail, Ho Chi Minh had attended a ceremony in Son Tay, 30 miles west of Hanoi, to congratulate the first graduates of a unique new school. This date, 19 March 1967, coincides with that cited by post-war North Vietnamese publications as the organization date for Special Operations Forces in the Vietnamese People's War. And it's the same date that North Vietnam's only paratroop unit, the 305th Airborne Brigade, which by no small coincidence was based at the same town, Son Tê, was disbanded. Clearly, the North Vietnamese had converted their Soviet-trained parachute unit into a new special operations organization. The 305th soldiers were hand-selected, well-trained, and much better equipped than an ordinary NVA unit, and they were true believers. North Vietnam's most politically reliable force, the equivalent of Nazi Germany's elite SS units. More than half of the 305th Brigade's paratroops became sappers, the suicidal night infiltrators renowned for penetrating American base camps, wearing only shorts and carrying satchel charges. Sappers were respected and feared throughout South Vietnam. Unknown to American intelligence, another 305th Brigade element became special counter-recon units whose mission it was to hunt down and kill SOG teams. This idea wasn't entirely new. During the French Indochina War, the communist Viet Minh's 421st Intelligence Battalion existed solely to track down French commandos and tribal mercenaries of the top-secret Groupement de Commandos Mixtes Aéroportés, GCMA, which fought behind communist lines. The new NVA unit's overlap with sappers was verified when twice SOG teams were hit in their night positions by NVAs stripped to shorts who came in silently with only AKs and grenades, the well-established sappers' modus operandi. In the first instance, all the Americans were killed. In the second, all were missing. MIA were Staff Sergeants Gunther Wald, William Brown, and Donald Shue. It appeared that one enemy counter-recon battalion roamed between the area just west of Khe San and Chepon. Another battalion likely operated between South Vietnam's A Sha Valley and the major sanctuaries 20 miles west of there. And a third battalion patrolled the southern Laos-Northern Cambodia region. Accompanying the new counter-recon units were NVA soldiers trained as trackers and stationed at strategic points along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, to be called in whenever the NVA discovered evidence of a SOG team's presence. Enough tracker teams were available that less than 24 hours after a U.S. boot print was found near the Laotian POW camp holding U.S. Navy Lieutenant Dieter Dengler, halfway between Mu Ya Pass and Chepon, multiple tracker teams arrived to hunt the SOG men down. The recon team eluded its trackers. Lieutenant Dengler later escaped, the only U.S. Navy pilot to make his way out of Laos. Trackers would have been bad enough, but some came with man's best friend, dogs. The NVA dogs weren't true bloodhounds, but rather ordinary beasts taught simply to follow a scent, which they did competently. Not as numerous or available as human trackers, the dogs apparently were dispatched from important NVA base areas. 10 Joe Walker was one of the few recon men to carefully observe an approaching tracker dog. Walker found it a little old, bug-eyed, ugly-looking dog. But the son of a bitch could smell a bit. Not real well, but he was tracking me. He disposed of both dog and handler a moment later. The most complicated cat-and-mouse game I'm aware of pitted a North Vietnamese counter-recon company against RT Main, in a three-day contest distinguished by the enemy commander's persistence, patience, and fatal overconfidence. It began like many a recon mission with Maine's 10 Staff Sergeant David Baker, his 11 Sergeant Sherman Miller, and 12 Sergeant Mike Buckland, and 5 yards, creeping through an NVA base area when they were picked up by trackers. Baker led Maine through a couple of evasive turns, a side slip, and a double back. It should have shaken the NVA off, but didn't. Instead, one enemy platoon, then another, arrived, formed a line, and began sweeping the jungle. Baker sidestepped one platoon, then circled around behind the second. They heard nothing that night. But again the next morning, trackers and platoon-sized forces swept behind, beside, and in front of them. Baker would advance cautiously, fall back, pause, advance again, dancing between his determined pursuers. By late afternoon, a pattern was discernible. The NVA commander was attempting to push them east, where they'd be pinned against a steep ridge or forced into open ground. Baker did his best to resist, but inevitably RT Main was being herded in that direction. That night the Sogmen lay low, but the pattern continued at dawn. All morning Baker did double backs and sidesteps, but now the NVA commander ordered his company into a single formation, with two platoons reaching out in a Y to ensnare the Sogmen, the third platoon following in reserve. Baker could sense the noose tightening. He saw but three options: become fatally pinned against the ridge, be pushed into open country, or, before he ran out of maneuvering space, take back the initiative and attack. Baker opted to attack more than 100 NVA. Late that morning he came upon a decent ambush site, an open expanse his pursuers would have to cross. He hustled Main to where the far wood line dropped off about 20 feet and arrayed them in a linear ambush. Soon they heard the NVA approaching, but they halted just out of sight, apparently for lunch. Most of the enemy stayed in the far wood line, but one platoon fanned out along the clearing, almost to where RT Main lay in ambush. Ben Baker's men couldn't believe their eyes. 9 enemy soldiers walked to within 10 feet of them, sat down, and started eating. It was the company command element, complete with radio operators and 2 Chinese advisors. It was a tempting target, but Baker didn't like all those other nearby NVA, so he signaled his men to stay motionless. They did for about 40 minutes. Then a Montagnard grenadier pulled his .45 pistol and cocked it. With that metallic click, all 9 enemies stopped talking and turned their heads. 2 reached for their AKs. The instant Baker fired, all RT Main let loose, and not 3 seconds later, all 9 enemy soldiers were dead, and the Sogmen were running for their lives. 100 AKs returned fire, but it went high because RT Main was sliding downhill without looking back. The real lifesaver was that they'd decapitated the enemy by killing not just the commander and his 2 Chinese advisors, but the 3 platoon leaders who'd joined them for lunch. An hour later, RT Main was extracted with only 2 men wounded slightly, and at last Baker's interpreter could tell him that over lunch, the enemy officers had been boasting that they'd have at least 1 American POW by nightfall. The new counter-recon units made life more hazardous for SOG men, but there was a discernible difference in enemy attitude, too. Until 1967, SOG's men had fought a rather ordinary cross-section of NVA, everything from rear echelon clerks to hardcore infantry, but the politically reliable counter-recon units added zealotry to the contest. That's the best explanation for what happened to 10 Sergeant First Class Paul Miguez. Miguez, Glenn, and Pilton are pseudonyms. It began when a Covey FAC overflying southern Laos reported, "I've got somebody screaming on the radio." A youthful voice pleaded, "Please, please, come and get me." The FAC calmed him enough to learn he was alone, split from his team, but he couldn't explain what had happened. A recon team led by Miguez, along with SFC Bill Pilton, his 1-1, and a young specialist 4, Mike Glenn, their 1-2, had been in Laos 3 days. A former Marine, Miguez had a previous tour with Project Delta, the 5th Special Forces Group's in-country long-range recon unit. Both Pilton and Glenn were relatively new. Miguez realized their insert had been observed by LZ watchers, but thought he'd shaken them. Apparently not. Another 10, Sergeant First Class Fred Zabotowski, had been extracted from a nearby target that day, and he'd heard the pleading voice too. He was at SOG's Dock To launch site when word came to insert a bright light rescue team. To Fred's disgust, the bright light team leader, a non-Special Forces NCO from a conventional unit who'd mistakenly volunteered for SOG recon without knowing what it was, invented excuse after excuse to avoid launching. A veteran recon man on his second SOG tour, Zabotofsky shook his head and announced, "Screw it. I'll go. Let's go get him." By the time his Huey got to the area, another Huey had extracted the young man, whose voice had been on the radio, using a Maguire rig, a sort of rope swing dropped through the jungle canopy. Zabotofsky's Huey tried three times to land where Miguez's team had inserted, but heavy fire erupted each time. Their damaged aircraft barely made it out, then had to auto-rotate at Dokto. That evening, Zabotofsky heard a fantastic story. The young Specialist 4, Glenn, had come out with just his clothes, he explained, because the NVA had taken everything else away from him. Still shaken, he described how the NVA had forced him to talk on his radio, then put him in the Maguire rig. If this was true, why didn't they shoot down the Huey, which should have been child's play? Because they wanted him to get out, he said, so he could tell what happened to Miguez. The NVA had surprised the team that morning, he said. They'd been overrun so fast that no one got off a shot, although the 1-1 Pilton managed to escape. The rest were captured. An English-speaking NVA officer told Glenn to watch carefully. Then they cut Paul Miguez's belly open, and his intestines fell to the ground. The officer took a flamethrower from one of his men, stuck the nozzle in Miguez's stomach, and literally melted him alive, burning him horribly, while the young Specialist 4 watched. The NVA officer told him to tell his Green Beret friends that this is what waited for them in Laos. A number of recon men doubted the story, thinking perhaps the 1-2 had hallucinated, but they knew never to discount anything. A visiting SOG lieutenant colonel from Da Nang badgered the traumatized youth, even calling him a coward. Then he turned his vial on Zabotofsky, demanding to know why he hadn't landed, and when he was told the Huey had been shot full of holes, he called Zabotofsky a coward, too. "Okay, Colonel," Zabotofsky said. "Tomorrow morning I'm going back in there with nothing but 3 Americans and 3 yards, some body bags and ammunition. And if you would like your first tour of Laos, seeing as you have not been to Laos, I want you on the lead ship with me." The colonel went along, but tried to scrub the insert when they took ground fire. Zabotofsky already had talked with the pilot, who disregarded the colonel's pleas. After all, Zabotofsky was the operation commander, not the colonel. The colonel did not get off the helicopter with the recon team. But miraculously, another circling helicopter spotted the missing 1-1, Pilton, and extracted him. Meanwhile, Zabotofsky found the team's back trail, followed it 600 yards to a hill crest, looked over, and could see gear strewn where the team had been overrun. A little farther on, he found black streaks where a flamethrower had scorched the ground and trees. Then just ahead, something was smoldering. It turned his stomach. The hideous, sadistic murder of an unarmed man surprised Zabotofsky, who explained, "That was the first time I ever knew the NVA to do anything like that." Several Montagnards lay there, too, burned to death. It was another dangerous day before Zabotofsky got Miguez's body out. Enemy pressure was so great, he had to abandon the yard bodies. Chief Sog personally relieved the bellicose colonel. Paul Miguez, who displayed incredible courage while his captors burned him alive, was posthumously awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. SOG recon men saw the Miguez incident as proof of what lay in store for them if captured alive. Such inhumanity was borne out again and again, with particular confirmation coming from the June 1967 Hatchet Force raid in Target Oscar 8. About 25 miles northwest of South Vietnam's A Sha Valley, Oscar 8 encompassed the Highway 922 turnoff from Highway 92. More USAF planes were downed at that road junction than any place in Laos, which isn't surprising since burrowed deep into the hills of Oscar 8, defended by belts of anti-aircraft guns, was North Vietnamese General Vo Bam's 559th Transportation Group's forward headquarters, the Ho Chi Minh Trail's control center. Both SOG and the Air Force had suspected as much, with USAF intelligence determining Oscar 8 contained the largest depot outside North Vietnam. Sergeant John Meyer, who ran recon near Oscar 8, recalled, "The area was really hot. I mean, every team that went in there got the shit shot out of it." Just before the 1967 raid, U.S. signal intelligence each day detected 2,300 radio messages emanating from there to North Vietnam, a volume unparalleled throughout Laos. General Westmoreland believed an NVA field army headquarters that controlled all enemy operations in South Vietnam's First Corps was located there. Oscar 8's terrain favored the enemy, with the only suitable LZs in a wide bowl, surrounded by jungled high ground containing anti-aircraft guns and bunkered infantry. The raid began with a dawn arc light by 9 B-52s. Flying Covey, Master Sergeant Billy Waugh watched nearly 1,500 and 750-pound bombs walk across Oscar 8, setting off 50 secondary explosions. Incredibly, the bombs had barely stopped falling when he could see NVA running from their shelters to roll fuel barrels away from a fire. Waugh radioed SOG Lieutenant Colonel Harold Rose at Khe Sanh, "I've got people out here scurrying around. That son of a bitch is loaded." As the smoke cleared, 9 King Bees and 5 USMC CH-46 Sea Knights landed a Nung Hatchet Force company. The arc light temporarily silenced the flak, but hardly had the raider company arrived when NVA soldiers were everywhere, surrounding the 100 SOG men who had taken cover in a few bomb craters. They began calling in gunships and TAC air danger close. Then NVA flak opened up, hitting an A-1 Sky Raider, when his wingmen flew beneath him to check damage, and updraft bounced them together. The undamaged A-1's propeller cut off the other's tail. On the LZ, Sergeant First Class Charles Wilklow was horrified to see the tailless A-1 plunge into the ground. No one ejected. But his attention is quickly returned to the Nungs and Americans crowded around him in a bomb crater, raked by fire and surrounded by hundreds of NVA. The Hatchet Force Company had enough firepower to cut down any NVA assault, but not enough to themselves assault the NVA. It was a perfect stalemate, lasting all afternoon, then all night. Not long after dawn, helicopters, supported by a dozen fighters, took off from Khe Sanh to retrieve the company. After the fighters strafed and dropped cluster bombs, two USMC Huey gunships passed low overhead. Both were shot down. Then a King Bee went in and it burst into flames and crashed. Next, a USMC CH-46 settled among the bomb craters, took some hits, but lifted safely away with almost a platoon aboard. Then flak connected with an Air Force F-4 Phantom fighter, which plowed into a hillside, bursting into a greasy orange fireball. On the LZ, 3 Green Beret NCOs, Charles Wilklow, Ron Dexter, and Billy Ray Laney, readied the next chopper load of Nungs. And when the 2nd Marine CH-46 came in, they and 24 mercenaries leaped aboard and returned the heavy ground fire as they lifted away. Riding with Covey overhead, Billy Waugh wished that Marine chopper into the air, but streaming tracers stayed right on it. Inside the CH-46, Wilklow could see bullets punching both sides of the aircraft. Then one pilot was shot, and it veered out of control, hit the trees, spun violently, fell 100 feet and broke in half. Enemy fire didn't let up a bit. Injured and dead Nungs were piled everywhere, but somehow Wilklow scrambled to his feet and shot at the nearby NVA, who were riddling the wreckage with bullets. He saw Billy Laney was chest shot, crumpled over and probably dead. He couldn't see Ron Dexter. Then the Marine door gunner beside him was shot in the head and slumped over his gun. Wilklow took a slug in his right leg and rolled out of the chopper. One pilot materialized, said he had to go back inside and get something. He never came back. With shouting NVA all around, the Green Beret couldn't wait, Unable to walk, he began crawling. He was lightheaded from blood loss and had to remind himself to check ammunition. He had none left, so he buried his Kar-15. By then firing had stopped. Strength almost exhausted, he forced himself to crawl a few more yards, then collapsed and looked up, and for the first time noticed an NVA soldier watching him from 60 feet overhead. Sitting on a wooden platform beside a 12.7mm machine gun, smoking a cigarette, his feet swinging over the edge. Superbly camouflaged gun platforms were in trees all around him, and now Wilklow could see he'd crawled right into an enemy base camp, and NVA were everywhere. And he was too weak to resist. High overhead in the FAC plane, Billy Waugh shook his head at the black smoke billowing where 5 aircraft had crashed. Not even half the hatchet force had been lifted out. From this point on, all they could do was watch for evading survivors. Charles Wilklow, too weak to move, expected to be seized. But the NVA soldiers merely walked over, saw his condition, and left him there. They didn't tend his wounds and gave him nothing to drink, sentencing him to death by indifference. Wilklow passed out. By the time he awoke, his web gear had disappeared and he'd been dragged a few yards into a clearing, an orange panel laid out beside him. NVA machine guns covered the spot in hopes U.S. helicopters would come to his rescue. All day Wilklow stayed motionless in the tropical sun, resolved to appear dead so no one would fall for the trap. While SOG aircraft looked for any sign of the missing men, Wilklow watched the NVA carry away several American bodies, then mount their heads on stakes like trophies. American POWs were led past, but he couldn't tell who they were. Lack of food and water kept his mind hazy. He slipped in and out of consciousness. He awoke the second day to see 2 Caucasians in civilian clothes watching him from a distance. They were escorted by an NVA officer. He concluded they were Russians. The Green Beret thirsted mightily, but the NVA offered him no water. He probably would have died that second day, but he lapped up water from a muddy puddle. Enemy soldiers strolled over and urinated in the puddle, chuckled, and walked away. Then there was the pig, an NVA private whose nose had been cut off, leaving him just 2 grotesque holes in his face like a pig's snout. Such disfigurement was an ancient punishment for lying or thievery. This outcast teased and taunted Wilklow, relishing the chance to lord it over something even lower, a dying American. The pig's hideous, haunting gaze was there for hours at a time, and Wilklow had nightmares about it. By the third day, Wilklow was indeed dying. It rained on him for hours, and he shivered uncontrollably, exhausted as hypothermia set in. The NVA gave him not a crust of bread, not a rag to bind his wounds, and he drank only from the urine-scented puddle. On the fourth day, he squirmed when he saw maggots crawling in his open wound. Shriveled up and shaking, Wilklow barely clung to life. The NVA no longer even bothered watching him. His usefulness was about over. Perhaps he'd look convincing one more day, and maybe they had one last chance to lure in a helicopter. That night, the last of Wilklow's strength began slipping away, and he knew he was on the verge of death. Like many people facing that abyss, his thoughts went to his family, to his wife and 3 children. He saw his little 9-year-old daughter Kathy's face, and Charles, 7. But especially he recalled Randy, his 3-year-old, and how he'd cried and tugged on him, begging Daddy not to leave them all for something dangerous called Vietnam. Charles Wilklow was not a religious man, but for the first time in his adult life he prayed, fervently prayed, for God to help him live to see his family again. If only he could find the strength to move. In the darkness, cold rain pelted his face. He felt a twinge of energy somewhere, and though he couldn't stand, he forced himself up on all fours. Pain almost consumed him, yet that God-given pain jolted him into consciousness. He moved his good knee forward, dragged his bad one, gingerly at first, then again. He repeated the movements, then faster, again and again, and with each yard, hope grew a little. Weak, feverish, several times he had to pause and sometimes passed out, but he always woke up and started again. The pain kept him going. He fell face first and slid down a rain-slicked hillside. The pain surged, but Wilklow kept going. He hallucinated that men were watching him. He forced himself back into reality. By sunrise, he must have crawled and dragged himself nearly 2 miles. That morning, several NVA, eating breakfast from aluminum rice bowls, walked past the little puddle where Wilklow should have been lying. The American wasn't there. Unalarmed, they looked beneath some bushes, then noticed scrapes in the soft clay where the American had dragged himself. One shouted, and in an instant the whole camp came alive to a clanging gong. Dozens of NVA dropped their rice bowls and grabbed AKs, then streamed out after the escapee. The sun was high when Wilklow heard a plane, crawled into a small opening, and miraculously found a cloth panel the NVA had missed when emptying his pockets. He waved it weakly, rolled over, and slipped into feverish sleep. Sometime later, a shadow above him blocked the sun. If they were going to kill him, Wilklow could not resist, could no longer even crawl away. A face began to take shape. The hideous pig? No. The face was black. A black American who shouted, "Charlie! Charlie!" And two strong hands lifted him. Those of SOG Staff Sergeant Lester Pace, who just rappelled in, a one-man bright light team. Pace dragged the dehydrated and nearly dead Wilklow to a nearby LZ. Then the sound of whirring rotors and a king bee appeared, and they were rising, ascending from that place of horror. And rushing air bathed Charles Wilklow back to life. He shook and sobbed and tried to talk, but he could not. Later, General Westmoreland visited Wilklow at the Da Nang Evacuation Hospital, spoke a few private words to the emaciated NCO, and pinned a purple heart to his pillow. In all, 23 Americans were lost in Oscar 8. SOG Raiders, Air Force pilots, and Marine helicopter crewmen, plus twice that many Nongs. Of the 6 American MIAs, Hanoi admitted capturing only a door gunner, USMC Lance Corporal Frank E. Seas, Jr. After his 1973 release, Seas told Ron Dexter's brother Ted that the Green Beret had been captured and died while in enemy hands. These incidents of 1967 not only made SOG men aware of the enemy's improving capabilities, but told them what lay in store if their foes captured them. Eventually, 58 SOG Green Berets were MIA in Laos and Cambodia. Charles Wilklow was the only one ever to return. 6. Daniel Boone. Ted Wikorek bounced in the little bird dog spotter plane's back seat, snapping photos from an open window. His were the educated eyes of a former SOG recon man turned aerial photographer. He found interesting what lay beneath him. Through his viewfinder, Wikorek was focusing on northeast Cambodia's Highway 19, a hard-packed dirt road, 2 lanes wide, obviously heavily traveled, but there was practically no civilian presence visible, no towns or villages, no people walking or leading animal-drawn carts on the road, no automobiles or trucks or bicycles, hardly anything. "That's the thing that was amazing," Wikorek concluded. "Here's this beautiful road, and there were no vehicles in daytime." A much better road than the nearby Laos and Ho Chi Minh Trail, northeast Cambodia's Highway 19, was, for political reasons, immune from U.S. bombing or ground attack, and it led nowhere. It headed due east and petered out about 5 miles from South Vietnam's border. Why? 20 miles further on lay Pleiku, the most important town in South Vietnam's central highlands, along with East-West Highway 19, long a communist target as they sought to cut South Vietnam in half. In October 1965, just 12 miles southeast of Cambodian Highway 19, in the Ia Drang Valley, the U.S. 1st Air Cavalry Division lost 304 troopers, KIA, to two NVA regiments that had traveled on and been supplied across the Cambodian Road. When the communists broke off the engagement and fled 5 miles west, they entered neutral Cambodia, where they were protected from U.S. action. In 1966, Highway 19 was secretly connected to nearby Laotian Highways 110 and 96, meaning the Ho Chi Minh Trail did not end in Laos, but clandestinely extended south into Cambodia. By late 1966, SOG recon men in southern Laos regularly watched NVA trucks overloaded with troops turn into Cambodia, and once across that border, the NVA knew they were secure even from SOG's prying eyes. To some extent, the Vietnamese communists had operated from Cambodian soil since the early 1960s, but all these infractions grew to wholesale proportions after Cambodia's ruler, Prince Norodom Sihanouk, closed the U.S. embassy in Phnom Penh in May 1965, eliminating diplomatic cover for CIA intelligence-gathering efforts and thus concealing his secret duplicity. Years later, writing from exile, Sihanouk admitted he closed the embassy to disrupt CIA operations. While SOG recon and hatchet force men were risking their lives